At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.
The Future Proof Podcast from Newstalk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof the Podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McCrae. Thank you for subscribing and downloading and rating the podcast. If you like it, please do that because it helps us in some intangible way. The digital team say it's important. I have no idea what it does. Maybe it rings a bell somewhere, but we do appreciate it. I've sort of talked it down now, but it does matter apparently, so please do it. Coming up on this week's program, we're going to be speaking to one of the researchers heading up a team of scientists all across Europe trying to build a digital model of our brain. And if you listen to this program at all, you know how complex this structure between our ears is. The idea that we can create a digital model where we could test out drugs, we could model disease, we could figure out consciousness, perhaps. It's such an audacious project. We'll be speaking to Dr. Katrin Amundst in a few minutes' time. But first, it's time to look back at the week's science news. And joining us, as always, Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and double Dr. Lara Dungan. You're both very welcome. Our first story. Is regrettably, Lara, to do with vaccines again?
Yeah, so it is. It's about the COVID vaccine. I suppose I'm going to preempt this by saying it is a little bit of a negative story, but it doesn't have to be all bad news. A new paper was published in Nature this week. It was actually originally came out as a sort of a pre-proven paper in BioArchive in January, and they put more effort into it, more data, and they've produced the full paper now. And this is showing that the antibodies that are produced by the vaccines that we have been giving for the coronavirus may not be as effective or at all effective against some of the newer strains. So that sounds very negative. What they found is, first of all, if you look at the overall studies they did, phase three trial studies of the Novavax vaccine in the UK and in South Africa. And they found that the same vaccine was about 90% effective in the UK, but only around about 50% effective in South Africa. So you would imagine that that is due because underlying the population are largely similar. So you would imagine it's due to the variant of the virus that is circling there. Unfortunately, they did further lab studies where they took the antibodies that vaccinated people produced, so people who had the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines, and they put them in with the virus to try and see if these antibodies could neutralize the virus. And they found that the new UK variant, so the variant that was famously spreading in the UK in December and has come to Ireland a number of times, the antibodies were twofold less effective at neutralizing that virus. And very unfortunately, for the South African variant, they were around 6.5 to 8.5-fold less effective at neutralizing that variant of the virus. So the news is not good. And what it means is that if we don't curb the spread of coronavirus, if we don't stop it spreading and therefore stop it mutating and evolving, we may be chasing this virus potentially forever, like we do the flu. So we need to get people vaccinated early, so that they don't catch it. It doesn't have a space to spread or mutate. And we have to social distance and try and keep away from people. I'm working in a hospital and we're still seeing people coming in saying, oh yeah, I caught this at a 50th birthday party and so did, you know, my 8 sisters. Oh, I caught this at a wedding and so did 20 other people. And it's really upsetting. I'm kind of putting my head in my hands every day saying, please stop. And it has really serious consequences. We can't depend on a vaccine to save us all by the end of this year. So please, people, be responsible, because the vaccine may not be the savior we think it is.
Yeah. And look, I can see your face is sort of pained over Skype, because it's hard to you know, to be to give out to people when it's so frustrating for us all.
I know.
We all want to go to shebeens. We all want to go out to nightclubs. We all want to go to weddings and enjoy and be able to mourn our dead. And if we don't social distance, if we keep breaking the rules for ourselves, then we'll never get out of this loop. And and it's just, it is hugely frustrating that we're still seeing 500 something plus cases, and I haven't seen it, seen the breakdown. I probably should have seen it in terms of where we're getting, but never saying there is still quite a lot of community community transmission, that
so
it's not
much.
Just, you know, retail workers or essential workers. And I don't know what else we can do. I really don't know where we need to go with it. So let's move on to our second story.
Because please
does
do.
Anybody have anything positive to add to that? No, not really. But it's an important point to make. And that's why we led with it. We need to social distance. We need to wash our hands. We just can't let up our guard. Second story has to do with a joint China-Russia adventure in space.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is like a great place to be socially distant. You could go live on the surface of the moon or maybe in orbit of the moon. And as you said, it's between China and Russia. Do you know the name of the Russian space agency? It's a good one. It's Roscosmos, which always makes me think of Roscommon for some reason, as if Roscommon had a space agency.
Yeah, that's right. I'd forgotten it, but yeah, Roscosmos, yeah.
They want to work together to carry out experimental research either on the surface of the moon or in orbit. And this is sort of reflecting a bit of a renaissance in Russian space interests. It's 60 years this year since the Russians sent Yuri Gagarin into space. And later this year, they're going to launch their first lunar landing mission since 1976. So they're kind of getting back out there. And they're very keen to team up with the Chinese, and for this to be, I suppose, a counterpoint to the NASA European Space Agency missions that are going on at the moment, as everyone's familiar with the Perseverance mission on the surface of Mars. So they've just signed an agreement. They said they're going to put a lot of money and know-how into it, but we've no firm plans as to what exactly they're going to do yet.
Is there any chatter about this being the beginning of spies in space? Or are we naive to think that there are not already missions from each country via satellite observing citizens that are not their own?
Well, let's be honest. All space science came from, like, you know, geopolitical motivators. Scientists were clever enough to realize they could do good science on the back of that. But since the very beginning, since Sputnik was launched, like, they put it up there saying they were doing measurements on the high atmosphere. But really what they were doing was demonstrating that they could put things into space and that those things, in theory, could carry weapons and be pointed at any city in the world. So I don't think we're naive to imagine that there are broader geopolitical forces at work here. But let's just hope that good science can get done on the way.
Lara, our third story has to do with tinkering with pain switches in mice.
Yeah, I have to say, I really like this story, Jonathan. It was published in Science Translational Medicine. Pain is a huge problem. Anyone who's ever had chronic pain, which I thankfully haven't, will know that it is debilitating. It's exhausting. Even if you have pain for a week, you're exhausted on the other side, but it's really hard to treat. And it's hard to treat with medications that don't become addictive or depress your respiratory drive or all sorts of different issues. So these scientists in the University of California in San Diego used gene editing, so CRISPR-Cas9 that we've talked about a lot on the show before. And what they did was they looked at the protein channel that's on the membrane for pain-sensing cells. And they found a way to stop it being produced. It's called NaV1.7. And they spliced in genes to stop this NaV1.7 from coming fully to fruition, to being a well-working protein channel on these pain cells. And they did this in mice. And what they did was they poked the paws of these mice with thin nylon filaments. So what they found was that for the mice who had these, essentially these protein channels blocked, they were able to give them a much harder poke with these nylon filaments, before it caused pain. Whereas for the normal mice, it was a softer poke would cause pain in their little mouse paws. And that is brilliant and it's wonderful. And you think, great, what a breakthrough. Maybe we can block pain. But pain is there for a really good reason. It stops us doing damage. There are very rare humans who have mutations in this gene. And it means that these people can't feel pain and they don't have the warning signs. So you will see people who are missing parts of their hands, missing parts of their face. And it's really sad. But what they found with this was that these animals, while they didn't feel the severe pain when you were trying to inflict it, they did feel natural pain. They didn't have a dangerous level of numbness. So if you put their paw on a hot surface, they would retract it right, the same way as the normal mice. So this is just so exciting because you have to have pain for certain things, but you don't need chronic pain. So if this was to come to fruition and become a treatment, now they're going to move into studies in monkeys next. But if this was to work, it would be groundbreaking.
Yeah. I think we did a story on analgesic patients once because it sounds like, wouldn't it be great not to have any pain? But of course, if you break your leg, you need to know it's broken. Otherwise, you're going to really damage it. And there's horrible stories
Absolutely.
Of people who you don't have a great life expectancy if you can't feel pain because of the danger of infection and so on. So that is really, really promising work. And the idea that people who have been living with pain their whole lives may have that relieved in some way is fantastic. Our final story, Shane, is about reverse origami.
Yeah, absolutely. As a way to crack security on 17th century letters. So like when we want to send a message nowadays, we can be assured that most of it, if it's digital, is encrypted. Before that, when we sent post, we use envelopes and they're gummed up. So you'd know if someone interfered with your post. Before that, in the 18th century and before, people would take their written document and they'd fold it in an elaborate way to basically ensure that it wasn't read on the way to the receiver. They used a cunning combinations of folds, tucks, slips and seals in something called letter locking. And very little is known about that because, as you can imagine, most letters that were sent that way have been opened. But recently, some scientists in MIT got their hand on something called the Brienne Collection, which is a series of unopened Dutch letters from the 17th century, an incredible 577 of them. And they have used an elaborate array of computation and X-rays in order to read what's in those letters. Without opening them, crucially. So this is a whole new technique for conservators who work in museums. And what they're doing is relying on the fact that the ink that was used to write those old letters had iron in them. And the iron, of course, can be seen on an X-ray. And so if you take X-rays and you slice through the sealed envelope, you'll be able to distinguish the paper from the ink. Huh. And then you can use computational models to be able to digitally unfold that piece of paper and read what's in there.
No, that's awesome. That is so
cool.
Isn't it? You can see a picture of these letters on our Twitter page. It's twitter.com/newstalkscience. They're really doughty little things. But I love the fact that you don't have to unfold them to read what's in them. We don't have iron in our ink anymore, so you'd have to use a different technique if you want to scan your neighbor's post, I'm afraid. But what did this letter, because they did one that it didn't want to damage, what did it say? What was it about?
It was, the one that they've looked at in particular was about a will, which is very interesting. People are always very interested to see what's in those. And because it was never opened, we don't know whether that person's instructions were ever carried out. I suppose they're going to find out an awful lot about life in the 17th century in Holland. Most of these are probably like regular day-to-day things, probably not going to be state secrets in there. But that's very interesting to understand how people lived in the 17th century.
Absolutely. As I say, take a look. It's a really cute little thing. And I'd never heard of it until I'd heard this story. Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and, from nowhere, double Dr. Lara Dungan. Thanks very much for joining us. Now, the human brain is, to put it simply, pretty complex. To our knowledge, this fatty, spongy lump is the most complex structure we know of in the universe, containing 86 billion neurons or thereabouts, and many trillions more of connections between them. So could something like that ever be accurately mapped? And if so, how would we do it? Well, Dr. Katrina Munz is a neuroscientist and professor of brain research at Dusseldorf University. She's also chair of the Science and Infrastructure Board of the Human Brain Project. She joins me now. Welcome to the program, Katrina. Perhaps you might start off by telling me what the Human Brain Project is hoping to achieve.
Well, the Human Brain Project started in 2013 in order to contribute to a deeper understanding of brain organization, so how structure and functions are related to each other, but not only contribute to basic science, but to translate it into better medicine or also in neuro-inspired technology. So that was on our agenda.
So even if we just go back 8 years, the level of technology that we have compared to now is, it almost seems rudimentary because of Moore's law, right? That we have incredible tools at our disposal now. But at 2013, it must have seemed like a huge task to try and map the human brain and all of its circuitry.
Yes, but I would say at the same time, it was clear that computing is really moving very quickly, and digitalization started to change every little place in our society. And we saw that new computing technologies came up, AI came up, technologies like neuromorphic computing, which are built in such a way that they try to implement processes that we know from the brain to a computer, also started to work. So there were many, many developments that are now, of course, full and with high speed that started at that time. And that was one of the reasons that we said now the time is ripe to use these new technologies to benefit from it, but also perhaps to contribute to the development of these technologies through brain research.
So where do you start with something like that? Do you take a sort of reference brain from someone and start slicing it up in tiny pieces?
Well, the researchers that started in 2013 came from really different fields, and there was a broad variety of research approaches, of opinions, of ways to approach human brain complexity. And I myself, I'm coming from neuroanatomy and neuroscience, and I mapped the brain for more than 20 years at that time. Now it's almost 30 years now. And I wanted to understand how the different cells are distributed in the human brain. And the human brain is, of course, it's a body, it's a volume, it's an organ. And in order to really understand what the arrangement of cells is, what is their function, we need to get really good three-dimensional volumes, models of the human brain. And this was where I started from.
Right. And so building a 3D model of the brain, what do you need to know about it to start creating that map?
Well, I'm relying on a really long tradition and expertise of wet lab work. That means to process such a brain histologically, to cut it into very tiny, thin, 20 micrometer thick section. This is as thin as a human hair is. This requires really a long-term expertise, and we have it in the institute where I'm working. And in addition, there was also, of course, a tradition going back 400 years almost, that was looking to the way how cells are arranged. We call it cell architecture. And based on this knowledge, we started to map the brain again using modern tools of image analysis and statistical tools of analysis in order to make these maps reproducible by everybody and independent from the observer. So these was the ground where I started from. And then we went more and more into the depths of the brain, started to map it. And our vision was to create something like a Google brain, I would say, where you can zoom in and zoom out, focus on a certain brain region that you are interested in, and then try to better understand what is the structure of this certain region and why a certain function like language or attention or face recognition, why this happens in this particular area. And such questions were the driving force that helped us to build this atlas.
So the physical structure is one thing, and to be able to navigate a human brain like we do Google Maps would be hugely beneficial. But of course, the brain is an organ that that facilitates the transmission of electricity across it in lots of different patterns and different pathways. How do you go about mapping those sort of things onto the brain, or is that not something that you're currently working on? Are you looking just at physical structures at the moment?
Oh no, we are very much interested in the function of the structure we are looking for. And it's, if you allow me this metaphor, if you have a good map of a country and you see where are the railroads are going, you have a certain idea how the different cities are being connected and whether these are fast connections or very slow connections. But then, of course, you need to see the movement of the trains between the different cities. And it's a similar approach, I would say, for the brain. So we are interested in the structure, but this is only the first step. And then we want to better understand what is the dynamic of cells and how the dynamic of certain cell networks contributes to a certain brain structure. And it's not only electrical activity. The more difficult part, I would perhaps say, is a molecular structure. So the transmission of information is done by molecules like acetylcholine or dopamine, glutamate, and others. And they can modulate in a very tiny and very precise way the way how information is processed between the different cells. And we are studying this molecular architecture of the human brain as well and bring it together with the cellular architecture. So my answer to this question, how to approach the brain and how to better understand structure and function relationship, is that we are building a so-called multi-level atlas. So we bring into this atlas the structure of the cells, the connections between the cells, the molecular organization, the genetic organization, but also functional networks which are active when we execute a certain task, for example, move our fingers or dip our hands. And when everything, so to say, is converging in this one framework, which we call ATLAS, then I think we have a good tool to better understand how the brain works.
What about so-called functional MRI, the magnetic resonance imaging that we use to understand thought patterns because of the movement of blood around the brain? Is that something that you're using? Because there must surely be a huge amount of fMRI data there that, if you found a way to merge these, could be very useful.
Indeed, functional magnetic resonance imaging was a really pushing factor in the field, I would say. And we learned much more about the living human brain. And we learned where are the networks, where are the spots that we need when we are solving a face recognition task, for example. The limitation of this method is that the spatial resolution is rather poor. It's in the range of 2 or 3 millimeters. And this is quite far away from the microscopic resolution where the cells are sitting with all their branches and all their activities. So when we use now the ATLAS or speak about the ATLAS, then we combine precisely such data coming from living human subjects who are doing a certain cognitive task. And we combine it with microstructural data coming from postmortem brains, that is from body donors. And to make it in a very systematic way, our friends in France at Neurospin, they analyzed 12 subjects many, many times and very systematically with respect to all kinds of cognitive tasks that you can imagine.
Wow.
Like tapping fingers or hearing something, listening to music, speaking something, and very systematically maps the brain in functional terms. And then we come with our maps from postmortem brains and see what are the correspondences, where are the differences, and we move one step forward.
Obviously, if we were in a science fiction movie and we could fast forward into the future, you could imagine a model of the human brain being so useful that you could perhaps model an injury that a patient had and see how that is affecting speech and how that might be remedied, or you might be able to understand consciousness even if we got that far. These are the holy grails, I suppose, of neuroscience. What practically are we looking at in the next 10 years to get from this project, apart from understanding better our brains?
Well, consciousness is a holy grail, of course, of neuroscience, and there are different theories. But these theories, they are built on observations from the labs. They are built on observations of the dynamics of the brain. And it has very practical consequences when you think about different disorders of consciousness of people who are in a coma. Then it is, of course, important to have some measure that is objective and that helps you as a physician to understand whether this person is unconscious or whether he or she can still perceive some elements from the world. And to measure that is great. And in the Human Brain Project, my colleagues from Milano, Marcello Massimini, they are doing precisely that. So they try to better understand the physiological activity of the brain, then derive a mathematical theory from it, and to measure consciousness, and then translate it to brain medicine in order to better understand how deep a coma of a certain patient is. So I think it's not so much science fiction, it's already going into clinical application, and here the future has already started, I would say.
One of the issues with the Human Genome Project, which is sort of a similar idea to try and map out the human genome so we can explore DNA, its functions, and learn about potentially genetic diseases and so on. One of the issues of the early days of that genome project is that we were working off one reference human, and after that, only a few reference humans. With this brain project, I'm wondering, how similar are our brains from one individual to another, particularly when we take into account genetic differences, geographic differences, physiological differences? How similar are our brains, and will this model allow for these discrepancies, I suppose?
Well, brains are indeed different between us, and it's the same as you have a fingerprint. So everybody has a hand and has a skin, but the fingerprints are slightly different, and they are unique for every individual. And for the brain, this is a little bit the same situation. And therefore, it is so important to address these variations as a research topic. So not just to start from one brain or assume that if you know one brain, then you know all brains. This is only partly true. Indeed, there is a lot of variation, which is highly relevant when you think about medicine again. And some patients benefit from a certain therapy and others, unfortunately, not.
Yeah.
So we have to address and understand these differences and have, so to say, to quantify them also. And this is indeed one also of my research agendas where I'm very active. And things are even more difficult. So when we think about genes and something is switched on or off, and we have a very mechanistic view of the way how genes are acting. But then when you come to higher spatial scales of brain organizations, to the large scale networks, for example, then you see that the brain itself is reacting to environment, for example, and the brain is changing over time. So the brain is not a machine that is there because the genes have created a certain mechanism, and then you have, so to say, a little machine. It's changing all the time. And to better understand what these different relationships are between genes, environment, our brain, our behavior, our lifestyle, this is, of course, a really major scientific challenge, which will...
I mean, as you describe it there, I'm thinking it's one of those endeavors that I'm delighted that other people are doing, but also that there is such a large network of researchers working together, because it would be impossible to undertake something this gargantuan, even in just one team. If we manage to get a really good model of the brain, do you think we'd be able to try out new therapies and model how they might work? And could this potentially one day replace animal models that we use for testing so many drugs to do with psychotic disorders, behavior disorders, depression, and so on?
Yes, and we see the beginning of the development that you have drafted now. For example, we have a model that's a virtual brain where we create a digital model of a very concrete patient's brain. And then we can, so to say, simulate how this brain would react if something is happening. For example,
wow.
Surgery. Yeah, well, this is Victor Josa and his team in Marseille. They are now doing the first clinical trial for patients undergoing epilepsy surgery. And this epilepsy surgery preparation is supported by this brain model. And the first experiments, clinical trials, have shown that when you do the surgery in such a way as they predict, then the patient may more benefit from the surgery than if you're not doing it. And that would be extremely important, because for such surgery, the surgeons always have the questions, how much should I take away from this epileptic brain?
Right.
If I take away not so much, then the epilepsy is continuing. If I take away too much, then the patient may have side effects which are not wanted. And to have the right decision is extremely difficult. And if here this model will help, and this will be shown in this clinical trial, hopefully, then of course we can improve the benefit for patients very soon.
So I'd heard of augmented reality, how assisting some surgeons and research in this, but this is, you're talking about a virtual brain, a sort of a data brain being used to model how successful epilepsy research would be. That's phenomenal.
Yeah, yes, it is. I mean, this model is fed or is fed by information coming from neuroimaging data of this particular patient. And then the dynamics in this particular patient are being modeled. And then, so to say, they can better predict how to do the surgery. Yes, that's really amazing. And they are continuing to work on that and bring even more information into this model so that it is biologically even more informed and has an even more precise prediction for these patients. And I think these are very interesting and exciting roadmaps where we are now seeing more and more results.
I know this is a question that has no answer really, because I imagine work will go on this project forever, because you can never really complete it. But do you have a roadmap for when you might have completed, inverted commas, this big brain project and provide a model that maps pretty well the structure and how each neuron interacts with each other?
Well, at the end of 2023, when the human brain project will stop or will be finished after 10 years, I would hope to have provided for the community a true multimodal atlas where people can zoom in, zoom out, where they can all kind find of different information. But I would like to go even one step further and develop a model of the human brain at the 1 micron resolution. So why this is so important? Because then you can really appreciate the structure and the shape of every single cell in the brain. And this is, of course, important information for such models, like the models done in Marseille, to inform them and to make them more precise. And it will also help us to better understand how the networks in the brain are functioning. Mm-hmm. But this project, which will not be finished in 2 years, but I would say that's in a 5-year horizon. But in 23, I would hope we have a platform for researchers that others can contribute, but even more can benefit from what we have built in the last year. So that would be the aim. And this infrastructure is called eBrains, and that should be delivered in 2 years.
It's extraordinary, and it opens up possibilities of fully understanding what's going with MS, understanding the blood-brain barrier, all sorts of diseases and conditions that affect people's quality of life when it comes to the brain. And also, as we say, perhaps peeling back the curtain on consciousness. So it's a really, really amazing work that you're doing. Fantastic hearing about it. Dr. Katrin Amunz from the Human Brain Project, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me here.
I think I was more excited about the Human Brain Project than the person who's leading up the team. I think in fairness, I think I'm hearing it for the first time. And she's like, yeah, we're doing this, but it's an amazing thing that they've done. Aid McCovey, producer of Future Proof, joins me to go through the comments from last week. What did you make of that, Aidan? It's just one of those things. It's like going to space, or, you know, the Human Genome Project. It's a similar sort of thing. Like, it's just an enormous piece of work.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, I remember being announced, how many years ago was it? Eight years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, 8 years ago. I remember thinking, oh, that's cool. But I'm really impatient with these things. I'm like, can't they figure it out now? I can't wait for the results of this.
I mean, I wonder what it will look like and how. I mean, it sounds pretty in depth, this model, but like, to be able to model how drugs might work in the brain and that sort of stuff, that seems like a real holy grail for things like Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, depression, all those things, psychosis.
Right,
let's go through some of your comments from last week. We talked about the refractory period, which is the pause that is put upon men in between ejaculations for unknown reasons. We're not quite sure why, but we spoke to Susanna Lima, who is researching that very thing and watching animals do it and timing how long it takes and so on, which is always funny to laugh about. It is.
Life's other great mystery.
It's fun. I mean, it's fun to laugh about people watching animals do sex as a job. Person says, ha ha ha, awkward much? It's alongside the most awkward conversations I've had on the program. But like, I think I'm immune to it now. We could talk about anything on the program. I'd be like, this is science. This is fine. Everything's fine.
It's one of the ones you handled better. I think your kryptonite, aside from electricity, obviously, is it farts? For some reason, you have some issue with
just. You're gonna have to edit that out. I don't want that word in my podcast. I can't bear thinking about it or talking about it. It's just, that's something we will never talk about on the show. I will say that there is a bit of fun in those awkward sexual pieces. Like, it's a bit of fun as a presenter because there's a sort of a challenge of just doing it right, and a bit of, but not too much, and the appropriate amount of tittering, but like keeping that whole apple cart on the two wheels is a bit of crack.
I just wasn't sure where you were going with the apple cart metaphor.
Yeah, there you go. We were talking about lucid dreaming, discussion last week about researchers who have found a way to communicate with people while they are dreaming. Damien from Phibsborough says, I used to be a lucid dreamer when I was a teenager. I'd go to bed and decide what I wanted to dream about. I'd then be able to control my dream. Oh, man. Damien, you got to follow up and tell us exactly what you just, we won't read it out, I promise. What did you dream about? He says, sometimes going to familiar dream places and scenarios when I was really tired, I'd tell my mind to make up its own dream because I couldn't be bothered doing it myself that night. And I'd nearly always remember my dreams afterwards. That is so interesting. If I could make up my own dream, all I'd be doing is flying and traveling underwater. That's all I'd do.
Yeah. Flying through space as well, maybe.
I'd probably go clubbing actually right now. I think right now I'd go clubbing with zero consequences.
I've been having a lot of dreams, which is an aside, but I guess COVID dreams, where I'm having a few pints with some friends in a closet, like a really tight closet where none of us can get away from the other people. I've been having that recurring dream. I don't know what that says about.
Is a closet in Cavan by any chance?
In where?
In Cavan.
Not necessarily. Okay, yeah.
They shut down the cabin she being. That's why I was wondering.
All sorts of closets.
From Killarney Man, we got this text. As a lucid dreamer, it was alarming as a teenager, like controlling a movie later, aware mid-dream by realizing that things made no sense. Yeah, it's funny that you can like be in a dream and it feels so real to you and everything seems so real, but you don't question the ridiculous things that are happening and say, wait a minute. Gara in Dublin says, sometimes I realize I'm in my dream and I've controlled surroundings, certain things, but not always good. But usually that means I wake up soon after.
Yeah, that's what happens to me. That's what happens to me. I go like, I'm dreaming. I can do whatever I want. And then say I decide I want to, I don't know, eat a lot of chocolate, or I run over to where the chocolate is, and just as I get to it to pick it up, I wake up. It's the same thing every time. No matter what I decide I'm going to do, I run to get to there or start trying to do it. And the minute I get it close enough to actually do it, that's when I wake up. It's very strange.
All right. And let's try and do this apple cart thing. When I have a private... No, I can't do this. I'm trying to find a way of saying what I want to say without it being too much. And I don't know how to... Can't do it. Nope. No, there's no way in. It's a locked box. M in Cork says, when I fall asleep listening to talk radio, news talk, the radio discussion becomes totally part of my dream. Last night I was listening to Tom Dunn in my dream, and I knew I was listening to the radio, and in my dream I started to text into the show, is this lucid dreaming? When I re-listened to the podcast, Tom's interview was exactly as I had dreamt it. Well, if you were in REM sleep, it is highly possible you're a lucid dreamer, and this was you were incorporated. You can also incorporate into your dream and not be lucid. The lucidity refers to your ability to be aware that you're dreaming. Right. Patrick says, "Hi. As a youth, I regularly had dreams in which I could swim in the air above the ground. That's the sort of dream I want." I am now almost 69 years old and lucid dreaming is rare to non-existent. But about 2 years ago, I had a dream where I was curious in my dream if I dream in colour. When I tried to focus in on the perceived colour, the colour would leach out to what appeared to be the absence of colour rather than going black and white. We'll be interested to know if anyone else had a similar experience. Well, you can let us know by emailing science@newstalk.com or by getting us on Twitter. We're @newstalkscience. I had a dream that I was convinced in the dream this was real. And the dream, I forgot now, was a recurring dream. I'm only realizing now that I had recurring dreams. But I regularly dreamt that I could fly if I ran fast enough. Just very low above the ground, kind of like a wingsuit guy. But not for too long. And I always used to tell people, look, watch what I can do. And I'd be able to jump and I'd just kind of float horizontal, a bit like Superman, but very, like, about a foot and a half on the ground. So not very useful. And I forgot. It's such a fun dream. But I had that a few times.
As long as it didn't veer into your real life, you never try that. Look what I can do.
I did once when I was drunk, cycle home with my eyes closed. That was stupid, wasn't it?
Yeah. Don't do that.
Don't do that at home, folks. Gar from Dublin says, our Tibetan terrier used to perform delayed gratification, turning nose up at some food, knowing that he could get better food somewhere else. We were talking about cuttlefish. I can do delayed gratification. And then we were talking about electricity that transfers without wires by using microwaves. It sounds awesome and also highly dangerous. Michael Fogarty says, isn't this just lightning? Yeah, but it's you can't use lightning to drive your DeLorean. Wait a minute. No, you can't use it to power your house, obviously, unless you want like just one thing done at that very second and that needs a lot of electricity. And then someone else says, my brain is full. And that was only 3 minutes into the program. So I don't know how they'd deal with the whole episode. That's it from us on this week's Future Brief. Unless you have anything else to add, Aidan. I sort of ran into the run-up there, but you might have had something really spectacular or really personal to share or some revelation.
No, I'd used all my A material at the start of this.
Really? That was your A material? Excellent. Okay, yeah. I'm so glad we dial you in for these. Aidan McKelvey was producing. Simon Keane, Garrett Mahal, Steve Daunt are all on the production team. Steve McClune did sound. We'll be back with more Future Proof in the podcast feed on Tuesday. We're going to talk about flies and why they deserve our love with Erica McAllister. But in the meantime, stay curious.
Why? What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere, visit hyland.com.